You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, I'm BD Wong, and you're listening to And the Tony Goes To.
It's a look back at Broadway's most magical night, and all of the winners reminisce with delight. With their talent and brilliance, they always impress. And the Tony goes to my special guest.
Have you ever dreamed of winning a Tony Award? Did you ever practice your Tony acceptance speech in the bathroom mirror? Did you grow up watching the Tony Awards every year? Do you have a collection of Tony Award shows on VHS tape that you refuse to throw out? Well, then this is the podcast for you. Every week, I interview your favorite Tony Award winners, and together we go down memory lane as my guests share intimate and never-before-shared details about their Tony experience. By the end of every episode, you're going to feel like you just won a Tony. Welcome to And the Tony Goes To. I'm your host, Ilana Levine. Welcome today's Tony winner, B.D. Wong.
And the winner is B.D. Wong.
I would like to thank the brother and sister song and dance team, which have recently moved into my body and are now living there, for coming to the Eugene O'Neill Theater and getting along and... I celebrate this beautiful, beautiful thing with everyone who witnesses me tonight. I thank New York City for embracing my joy of performing. I thank the acceptance of risk that you have, it symbolizes for me the acceptance of the risk of everyone involved with a beautiful thing that is called M. Butterfly. I thank the support of all of my wonderful, wonderful friends, the best in the world. There are too many to name. McDaniel, I got the asterisk. I also thank the most important teacher and friend and a beautiful man into whose eyes I look every night at the Eugene O'Neill Theater and see two kinds of love. The love of a poor, deluded white devil for his butterfly and the love for a seasoned, professional, brilliant actor for his young protege. I also thank from the bottom of my heart William and Roberta Wong at 1886 40th Avenue, San Francisco. Yeah!
Hi, B.D. Wong.
Hello, Ilana Levine.
So, as you may be aware, you just won a Tony.
I did.
It feels like
seconds
real time.
Ago.
Just seconds ago. One of my favorite all-time things as someone who has listened to many, many Tony speeches religiously, ending with the address of your parents' home, maybe one of the sweetest, most personal moments ever. It tells such a story.
Yeah, I don't know what I was actually thinking. Of course, this was way before social media and even stalkers and things. You know, it was like not even a... I don't know. I was very naive about it. I don't know what I was actually thinking. I was just, but I will say that my memory is that my brain was overwhelmed with just all of these different kinds of thoughts and worries of covering everything or taking a moment or I don't know what. And so that came out of my mouth, and you know, people had funny things to say about it, and it was what it was. But it did speak to my tether to my parents. You know, I felt very indebted to them, and I felt very proud of everything that we went through in my relationship with them to get me to the point where I was actually a professional actor. And so that felt somehow the ultimate way in some way. I don't know what it was exactly. I'm not sure why I thought to do it that way. I can't remember.
Was that a preconceived notion, or did that happen spontaneously in the moment?
I cannot tell you. I doubt nothing was preconceived. And I think that it was probably just thinking, oh, yes, this is where they're from and this is who they are. And then the address came out of my mouth. I think that's what happened.
I love that. And I wonder, did people show up at their door wanting to congratulate them or?
No, I think my mom got some letters.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's about it. And that's thankfully, right? Because, you know, anything could happen in a situation like that. And especially nowadays, you think, oh my gosh, what would you, you know, but yeah. it was great. And so that, yeah, I wish I could tell you exactly what I was thinking, but maybe the fact that I don't know what I was thinking is useful.
Is telling.
Yes, exactly.
You won this Tony in 1988 for a Broadway show, which was your first, M. Butterfly. And, yeah. You know, there are so many incredible things surrounding the story of you and the show. One thing that was very sort of newsworthy at the time, but maybe less known to some of your newer fans, is that before that show, had they seen you in something and opened up the program, it would not have said B.D. Wong. It would have said your birth certificate name. And I wonder—
My government name, yeah.
Your government name.
Yeah.
I wonder, well, did you grow up being called B.D. by anybody?
No, I was never called BD when I was a kid. My dad had been called BD when he was a kid. And my two brothers and I and my dad all have the same initials. And when Stuart Ostro, who you know, he was a producer of M. Butterfly, asked me if I would take the gender out of my name, I said, oh, okay, great. And he wanted to just put B. Wong in the program, which I thought seemed really dumb. I said, well, that doesn't feel like a name, and it just feels kind of lame. It just feels like you're covering something up or something like that. So I recalled that my dad's nickname was BD, and I just used it. And I really had fully intended to just go back to my government name, which is Brad. Bradley is my name, and I was in Equity and registered in Equity and SAG as Brad. And so I was perfectly fine going back to that. But then after the play opened, it just became my name. And so I just stuck with it. That's the short version of the story. There's a lot of permutations of me going to the DMV and all of that stuff. But
well, that's always fun. Can you tell us the story of going to the DMV?
Well, I'll just tell you really quickly that within the last 20 years, I took the periods out of my name that were in the M. Butterfly program. It said B, period, D, period, Wong. And that was my name for a while.
Right.
And then I decided that it was really, for a lot of reasons, I didn't want to have two names anymore. So I wanted to commit to one name. So I encouraged people to call me BD, and I stuck with it. And then I decided, well, that means I have to really change all my credit cards and my driver license. So I went to the DMV, and the DMV would not allow me to have my name with periods in it. And it came out B, comma, D, period, was my name. And I said, that cannot be my name. I cannot say that on my driver's license. That's just horrible.
Right.
It just sounds terrible with a comma in the middle of my name. So I just said, oh, it's great. It looks great without periods, actually. I like it without periods. So I just kept it. But it was the DMV being really weird about it, like being impossible about it, like not allowing me to even put periods in the search field when you were typing, you know, that kind of
thing. Right. Yeah. So that, and thus the name was born as we know it today.
Yes. Thank you.
So I want to talk about how this life-changing role came to you. And if you could talk a little bit about how the show and Butterfly, for you as a really young actor with not many New York credits yet, ended up finding yourself front and center and winning every award possible for this show.
Yes. Okay. Well, I was living in Los Angeles. I had come to New York fresh out of like dropping out of college. I was very unhappy in my program at college, and I was not learning anything, and I felt very, very stagnant. And I said, I'm just going to go to New York. And I saved some money, and I eventually just got on a plane and went to New York, and I started working. I got my cards and stuff like that. But then eventually I got my first job, which was a tour of a show, and then it ended up in LA. And I was in LA, and then I decided, oh, well, here we're in LA. I'm going to stay here after the show closed. The show ran for about 6 months. And I stayed there, and I started working. I was working and was doing these small parts in TV shows and in little movies and stuff. And then I got this call from the agent about this play that I had no concept of. And he said, do you want to fly yourself to New York to read for a Broadway play? And I said, not really, because I was making a living and I don't know what this thing is. And that would be me spending $300 or whatever it was.
Right, to fly to New York.
Fly to New York for something that doesn't make any sense, because the odds are whatever. So I said, well, I suppose I shouldn't say such a thing unless I read the play. And so on Friday, I asked him to get me the play. And then on Monday, the play came in a FedEx envelope. And I read it, like 20 pages of the play. And as I was ripping pages out of the script, you know, reading from page to page, it was just like an amazing, validating experience to read the words of an author who spoke a language that I really understood. And I had, coincidentally, I was studying with Donald Houghton, my acting teacher, in a Hollywood basement studio, like, you know, like a $10 a class kind of class, but he was a great teacher. And one of the things, he studied with all the actor studio people, and he was saying, you know, this is what you are. You're a messenger. And the messenger is the person who breathes life into the author's words and commits to the ideas that the author is trying to convey. And I thought that sounded wonderful. And I said, well, I'm willing to do that, but I don't really know what that means. And so coincidentally, I read this play and I thought, oh, I see what this means now to commit your soul to be the messenger of this person's words and their thoughts and their ideas. And that's what helped me to get the part. Donald and I worked on the part. Donald worked on the part with me for months until the audition. It was maybe a couple of months until the audition. And I borrowed money from my mom and dad, like $99, to get on some cheapy airline to go to New York to have this opportunity. And I told them we were never going to see the money back and that I wasn't really going to get it. But there were kind of, you know, well-known people working on it. The director was a famous British director and all of that. And I said, I want to have the experience. I think the experience would be a good one to have. So I went to New York and I auditioned for the play. And then, you know, through the whole process of the auditions and the callbacks and reading with other actors, and they gave me the part. I never thought I would get the part, but I did say that it felt to me like a life-changing part. And I always said, well, if this person who gets this part does what they're supposed to do, then it will be really wonderful for them, is what I thought. And then I kind of regretted saying that as soon as I got the part. And
why the pressure of that?
Yeah, I thought, oh, don't jinx. You know, you shouldn't say that. You know, right. It was okay to say it when the part wasn't mine. It was okay to say that, right. But then the part became yours, and then you thought, well,
it's a good part. It's a good part. It serves the play. Yeah.
Exactly.
John Lithgow, that's the part. Yeah. Well, I want to talk about John Lithgow. Was he cast from the beginning, or was he someone who came on later?
No, this is really a good story because I've never really told this story before. I got cast first, and then I was called by John Dexter and Stuart Ostro a few months later. There was a delay in the production. They decided to kind of go later than they were going to go, and so there was a long delay. And they said, okay, we're ready to cast the leading guy now, and we want you to come to New York and read with them. And so I did so. And the three men were John Lithgow, Edward Herman, and Brian Dennehy. And it's a really long story, which I probably shouldn't get into because John Dexter was really not nice to me. And it's a rather traumatic story. But the point is that I read with all three of them, and I secretly fell in love with John Lithgow, and I didn't want to say so because I didn't want to tip it or be, you know, in the way of it. I think they did ask me my opinion at one point. David was, of course, there, the playwright, David Wong. And it was really clear that he was the guy for the part. I mean, he just came to life in the part in a way that was so moving and theatrical and right for the production. And he loomed so large, literally, and so there was just something wonderful about it. And then they gave it to him. And that began a kind of relationship with him that he was not bargaining for, because I was so green. Mm-hmm. And he really taught me at a very early age what it meant to be the leader of a company and what it meant to take charge and what it meant to be responsible and sensitive and mindful of people's feelings and of their experience. And it was probably the best part of the experience for me is my relationship with him. He really took care of me. And I really tested his patience. I was really inexperienced, and I had a lot of bad habits, and I had a lot of things that I had good instincts, you know, as an actor and all that stuff. And I was good in the part, I guess, but that all kind of goes away when you're working with somebody that doesn't really know exactly what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And he was wonderful. I mean, I can't say enough about it. He was constantly thinking of ways to bring it out of me that in a way that wasn't intimidating or in a way that wasn't demanding of him, so that I could give him what he needed and all of that stuff. He was great.
When you say that the director was unpleasant during the audition process, was that true? Were you battling with that or trying to handle that throughout the entire rehearsal process? Or did things find a meeting place once John came into the mix that felt safer for you? Or were you always having to work in a space where you didn't feel supported?
This is really interesting because this was in 1988 and this, or even 87 as it started. And it was before the concept of sex harassment. It was before Me Too. It was before all of these things. And there was a lot of game playing going on that I really don't want to get into, but I don't have to get into. The point is that I would absolutely respond to this whole situation in a very different way in 2020.
Right.
Now, and I was, there was already, I mean, when I got the part, I was warned by people about his relationship with young actors and, mm-hmm. and what that was like. And then it was really interesting the way it played out, because at first I saw no evidence of it. And I thought, oh, well, this isn't what they said at all. And then it turned at a certain point. There was always a little indications of it here and there, but I was very naive to it, and I didn't know what to look for, and so these things when a person is kind of manipulative in a certain way, and particularly with a young person, and this is why, you know, advocates for children are, you know, it's such an important thing to understand that a young person, and I wasn't a child, but I was a young person with a very limited experience. And so I'm coming to it from a very vulnerable place. And he's a kind of, what's the word, a figure that's an authority figure and leveraging his authority on me.
Right.
And you know, like, what is the first thing you, or what is one of the major things you're thinking when you get your first Broadway show? Don't get fired.
Right.
And so I did deal with that throughout the entire process, right up into 12 minutes before the house opened on opening night. And it was, in retrospect, I'm actually very proud of myself because I was very focused and I was very, I kept it together.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, when I think back, it really a nuisance and really kind of insidious. And so that was unfortunate. And that was one part that John Lithgow stayed out of because he was not really privy to it. He didn't really know what was going on.
Right.
And but it was a very interesting education, and it also gives me a real perspective for people that speak up now and that have that there's a real advocacy for the rights of a younger person in a relationship to an older person particularly in a kind of theatrical context. Because in our world, we touch each other, we do this, we do that. There's a lot more leeway than in another office kind of environment.
That's right.
And so there was that going on too.
Right.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Was this the first time you had played a woman?
Oh, no. I had played, well, first of all, there was a legacy of me playing women or being in drag throughout almost my entire acting identity. And it started when my drama teacher did Charlie's Aunt as the senior play, and she picked the play so that I would play that part. And I was really successful in that part. It was my first like real leading part in a comedy, and I had a blast doing it. And I understood seemed to not have a problem with the stigma of being dressed in drag, and that was a big part of it. And then there were other things that happened, like I got cast. Oh well, then I got cast in La Cage. I was in the singing ensemble of La Cage, and the singers in the original Broadway production of La Cage were in one number, the La Cage number, in drag. They weren't Cagelle as we know them. You know, the main core, of course, of the chorus in La Cage aux Folies is in drag all the time. And then I was like a fisherman, but then in the La Cage number, when they wanted more people, I was in drag in that. And so I was in heels and dressed as a showgirl and all of that stuff. And I was really comfortable with it. I mean, I was really good at it. And then before that, I was in, this was so amazing. I was in, on the Lower East Side, there used to be this theater called, what was it? It's named after a French theatrical avant-garde theater person. And it was called the Bowery Lane Theater. It's now a clothing store. And it was the Bowery Lane Theater, and it was called, the company was called something, was French. Okay. It was a pretty well-known company down in that area where La Mama and all those companies are.
Right.
And they were doing this production of a play called Epicene, The Silent Woman. And Epicene is like a restoration play, and it's about a man who marries this woman who won't speak. And then it turns out that the woman is a man. And I got cast in that part. And I remember that I had to leave to do something else. I got a job somewhere and I had to give the part up. I never got to do the part. I was all excited about it. There were costumes made and everything. And then I had to find somebody to replace me. They were really mad at me. And the person that replaced me was Alec Mappa, who covered the part on Broadway when I did M. Butterfly, and then who took the tour and went to LA with M. Butterfly,
yes,
who I knew as who I grew up with in San Francisco. So I said, oh, Alec, you should do this and come audition for this guy. And Alec came and got Epicene and then did Epicene while I was going off and doing something else. I forget what it was. And so that was one thing. And then, so there was Lacage and Epicene, and there was just thick things that came up every once in a while. Those were the main ones. And so I was comfortable with it. And
yeah.
I had no stigma about it at all at a time when there was much more stigma than there is now.
Yeah.
That's such a thing to brag about, but it was a little more challenging at that time to kind of calm yourself about your ability to access a different side of you or a side of you as a performer.
And also, I mean, whether you should be proud of it or not, I think that many actors at the beginning of their careers are very concerned with being typecast or being seen,
yes,
in one way. So,
so
the idea that you just took on these things you loved without self-consciousness or without concern for what that means for future casting, which we know, having known your story now, because we are looking back at this, the wide array of roles that you have done is extraordinary. And
well, yes,
all
and
of
I
them.
I thanks. And I think that it's part of my self-identification as a character actor. Mm-hmm. I never really wanted to look down on any part. And the part that was actually, if you really want to know, the part that was furthest from me was the part that was the most interesting and continues to be so. And now it's just now that I'm getting older that I'm enjoying playing someone that's closer to myself, that talks like me and that walks like me or that has my sense of humor. And that's new to me, kind of. I mean, I really have for many years, aside from my being on Law and Order, which was rather bland, the rest of it is all kind of character work. And I think it's because I gravitate towards this, a sense of I was going to say stretching, but it's like being something that you're not, or trying to explore performance styles and aspects of your performance that are as different from your own natural default setting as possible.
Yeah. Were there parts, first of all, were you familiar? I mean, for those of you who are listening, M. Butterfly is sort of fictional history. I mean, it's based on a real thing that happened between this Chinese spy played by you. And it's a memory play. So the context is John Lithgow or whoever plays the role is in a Paris prison, and it was present day at the time you were doing the play, looking back over a 20-year relationship with
this person
who
he
was a star.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No,
sorry.
I'm losing the phrase. Is it called Peking Opera? Am I remembering?
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Peking Opera star or performer.
Yes.
And idolizing her and kind of putting her on a pedestal as this kind of ideal, kind of feminine, mystique, kind of Eastern kind of fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that,
based on stereotypes,
based on stereotypes, yes, and because of that, he's unable to see it. It clouds his judgment as to the actual truth of the person that he's actually in this relationship with. That's kind of the germ of the play, I guess.
Now, when you talked earlier about, I can say my parents' address at the time because social media hadn't taken over life as we know it.
Yeah,
even the movie The Crying Game had not come out yet when you were doing this show.
Oh, yeah.
And you were a newcomer and your name did just say BD in the program. Were you aware of the moment? What was that like for a time where many audience members could actually come into a show not knowing what the
I'm going to call it a gimmick, even though that's not the right word for it, but the surprise.
There was a hook. There was a hook to it. And the hook really got people at that time. I think we kind of see there was a perfectly nice revival that just opened mm-hmm. and closed it last year or a year or two ago. And I think we see, among all the things we learn from time going by, is that plays play differently in different time periods, and the sophistication of the audience at this point does not really allow there to be any great revelation. David retooled the play, and the revelation is not really as big a part of
right.
it.
Right, understanding
the understanding
times we're this. Living in. And yeah. also that it's our hope that it wouldn't be something that someone would want to hide or be shocked by, that we live in a time where we would not that, need
absolutely.
To hide.
It's the opposite. Yes.
Yeah.
The stigma of it fed into the audience's fascination and to the audience's delight in discovering this. And that is a precious kind of thing that happened at that time that would not happen now. And that's really fun to think back on, because that was what made the play fun to do. You could feel the audience, and you could feel the audience kind of catching on. It's the craziest thing, Ilana, because it's written right in the play. It's written in the play, in the first few lines of the play, what the play is about, and people just didn't really hear it. They were very mm-hmm. much like the character that is telling them the story. They kind of didn't want, they just took me at face value. And as the play develops and the play unfolds, they realize with more and more gravity what he's actually talking about.
Right.
And then there is this kind of theatrical moment where I unmask myself, and it caused a fair amount of
I'm sure there was an audible reaction.
There was an audible reaction. Well, the one thing that happened was that very quickly, I took my makeup off in front of the audience. And I took my makeup off, and it took 4 minutes to take my makeup off in this really ritualized, stylized, choreographed kind of thing. But it was me just sitting at a makeup table, first taking my makeup off, and then undressing and redressing myself as a man. And the way the director chose to do this particular moment is he called it an intermission. And I said at the end of the scene prior, I said, oh, yeah, I'm going to change now. You guys go have a cigarette and do whatever you're going to do, but I'll meet you back here later. Mm-hmm. And they all knew that I was going to change. And the house lights came on. And then I sat there for 4 minutes, and nobody ever, ever, ever moved. They just sat there for 4 minutes, staring at me taking my makeup off. Like, some people who didn't know at that point didn't know what they were even looking at until like 3 minutes and 45 seconds into it. And then there were these stories of people just like losing their shit. And it was great. Or people would bring, their unwitting husband or something.
And let them go to the bathroom.
Yes. And you exactly. And then you'd hear stories. I always constantly heard stories, and still hear stories of people who said someone was sitting behind me, and you would not believe the reaction that they had. They just kind of freaked out. So that is something that just would not happen. And that it isn't really even a testament to my own performance. It really isn't. It's a testament much more to the time that we lived in, when a man in full non-drag, if you know what I mean. It was not drag queen drag. It was kind of a different, that was the other thing that was really different. It was not drag queen drag. It was woman drag. And that kind of drag was not something you saw that much. And you just accepted at face value a guy that was presenting themselves that way. And
well,
it was
especially if you're in America.
Yes, and it proved, yes, especially.
Right.
And it proved kind of the core value idea of the play, which is that you could see whatever you want if you want to see it. And that's what most people did when they came and saw it and didn't know what it was going on. They just accepted me at face value.
And you started winning every award. So by the time you got to the Tonys, What was your sense going in that night to the award ceremony? And I know you, are someone who loved all things theater and watched the Tonys. And so it must have been fantastical, all of it. But how did you feel that night? It wasn't fantastical.
It was a version of fantastical that is maybe surprising. First of all, it's a little bit like when I said, I read the script and I said, oh, this person's going to like really clean up, you know?
Yes.
And then here we were. And I was like, okay, well, I didn't really, you know, I didn't want to live under the notion that I felt that way. You know, I said that at one time and I thought, no, that cannot be where you're coming from when you go into this experience. And I also, this was the beginning or the turning point for me of appreciating the Tonys in a way that I appreciated them before as an audience member, as a fan, and as a person fantasizing to be an actor and all of those wonderful things. And I still feel the giddiness of excitement of the Tony Awards and all of that. But when I really got down to thinking about it, I became increasingly uncomfortable with the notion that we would actually pick 5 people a year and then pick one person to be the best one of those 5 people. It makes no sense to me. It continues to make no sense to me. I find it really uncomfortable. And I think this is one of the reasons why I don't really think about it that much. Mm-hmm. You know, as soon as the Tonys were over, I sent the Tony to my mom. It's on her mantle. I didn't want to look at it. I didn't want to think about the legacy of it. I attached Tony Award winning to my name in my bio. My agents make me do it, and I'm happy to do it because it's a fact. But at the same time, it fills me with a kind of conflict about why we're doing what we're doing and what the point of it really is. And it can cloud one's agenda when one is making choices in a performance. Mm-hmm. And it can cloud one's agenda when one is choosing what kind of work one wants to do or not. And I don't want to be clouded by that. And so I'm constantly turning it over in my head. What do I really think about it? What is my appreciation for it? It has opened doors for me. It has created an identity for me that, like I said, is attached to me now that I cannot deny. And at the same time, it is what it is, I guess. I guess I try to keep it in a certain perspective. And I encourage other people to try to keep it in perspective about what it is that it really is. It is a celebration of the theater. That night is undeniably a celebration of the theater in a medium that deserves and needs it. You know, every year we go, did people watch it? Do people understand what the theater is? You know, will CBS continue to air it because it's, you know, it's a never, nobody ever watches it. And every year we pat ourselves on the back and we turn to each other and we say, that was good, right? I mean, that showed well. We came off well, didn't we? Mm-hmm. And we want that and we need that. And that's where it's valuable to me. That's where it's kind of good. The kids at home who say, you know, they want to be actors and they see someone that looks like them, I'm all for that. That's like my thing. To answer your question, walking in the door, I thought, well, you know what? I did what I wanted to do. I went through that rehearsal process. I think that I did the work that I wanted to do. Like, I think I was asking myself, did you do this for anybody but yourself? And I really could say at the end that I did it. Because I had a challenge. My relationship with the director was really interesting and conflicted. It was never impossible or it was a little traumatic, but it was a situation in which I had to kind of think to myself, okay, am I in danger of losing what it is that I want to do because of mm-hmm. the way that I'm having to negotiate the rehearsal process. And I, at the end of the day, and this was when I say 12 minutes to opening night, and I was having this kind of, I can't go on kind of feeling in this dramatic mm-hmm. way on opening night. I kind of was able to say, no, you have done what you wanted to do. And that was what you wanted. And the people that are in the audience now my mom and my dad and all of the family and stuff, they were the ones who actually were the supposedly the recipients of the energy that I was putting into it. And I was glad that I could say that at the end, that I, okay, no, you know what, dude, I never did this for you. I never was doing this for you. And so that is kind of what walking into the Tonys was like for me. My brother, my older brother, Brian, who was never able to come to the show, was my date to the Tonys. And he sat by my side, and he was a very leveling, for the most part, a very leveling and very, very open to all the things that I wanted to bring to it. You know, we're not going to get all excited. We're not going to hope that I win. We're just going to enjoy the evening. And we're going to enjoy seeing all the famous people and being at the rehearsal and doing all of this stuff. And I was able to do that. And I am happy that I was able to do that and not get kind of caught up in it. And I feel like, Ilana, I feel like in my day-to-day life, I'm always trying to remind myself of that. Like, okay, let's just enjoy the party part. And let's not like get all carried away with the trappings of the swag and suitcases full of things that you don't need that you get, you know, in the red carpet room and, mm-hmm. and all of that stuff. That's mm-hmm. really easy to do. Yeah. And so that's how I felt going into it. I was very, whatever happens, happens. And in fact, I was very, it's okay to not win. It's really okay. And it's okay to, so I didn't hope to win, or I didn't kind of stoke that flame, and I ended up having a good time, and I ended up winning, and I think that I would like to say that if I hadn't, I would have been okay, and that would have been nice, and that it would have been a fun evening, and that there are lots of memories I have of it, and of the people who were a part of it around me that night that I can never forget.
Well, I usually end this conversation with three questions. You've already answered two of them. I ask, who did you bring? And you brought your brother. Were you allowed to bring any other guests that evening?
No, I don't think I was. I don't remember if I, you know, first of all, I was at a stage in my life where I didn't ask, you know, it's like, oh, this is.
Right. Oh, I get one ticket. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
I'll take whatever. I wasn't. And nowadays I'd say, you know, actually I need 10. Exactly. Thank you.
Exactly.
Get back to me.
Exactly.
But no, it was that. It was him. But then, you know, it was such a wonderful crew, and I had a wonderful dresser who is very dear to my heart. And you know, on that night, for a role like that, in the track that I had for the Tonys that night, you know, we had to perform scenes, which you don't do anymore. And then I was all dolled up to perform the scene. And then I had to kind of like do a quick, you know, well, you know all about the Tony quick change, but the Tony quick change to go get myself in the seat and all of
and
that.
And what did you wear on that night?
I wore John Dunn, who assisted Eiko Ishioka, the costume designer on M Butterfly, magnificent costume designer, gone too soon. John Dunn, who was her American assistant and really helped her through that whole process, designed me a tux jacket that was a long coat which was made of silk and leather, and had a like leather yoke on it. And Bob Colbath, the shop in the New York costume shop built it, and it had purple lining, and I wore cowboy boots, and I wore leather pants. I think I wore leather pants and a white kind of Seinfeldy poet shirt kind of thing.
Yes.
And
part Seinfeld, part George Washington.
Exactly. Yes. Part Hamilton, part.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And
what was the, yeah.
The last question is, where is your Tony? So you were saying at the time you sent it to Roberta Wong.
Oh, yeah.
Does it still live in her home?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's on her mantle in a little Lucite box she bought to put it in so that it doesn't get dust on it. And it's
and
on the mantle.
And you can visit it from time to time.
Yeah. I hardly remember that it's there, but I can visit it from time to time. A theater at one time wanted to borrow it for a benefit. And that was a big kind of a thing. And I shipped it to them and they shipped it back to her.
Right.
And it's on them, you know, it's like, it's classic. It's a classic my mother, anyone's mother kind of situation. It's on the mantle with pictures of my son and her other grandkids and their graduation pictures and, you know, people's wedding pictures and stuff like that.
B.D. Wong, I cannot thank you enough for being on this podcast today. Anytime. You know how I feel about you. And yes. Thank you for sharing so much of yourself today with of such course. Clarity and generosity. I love
well,
you.
Well, thank you. I love you too.
And The Tony Goes To is produced by Alan Seals for the Broadway Podcast Network. The music and lyrics for the theme song were written by Georgia Famusa. Theme song orchestration by Alexander Sage Oyen. Episodes are edited by Derek Gunther. Thank you to Parody Bill for the graphics. And please don't forget to go to the iTunes show page and rate and review the show. Thanks for listening. Excerpt from the Tony Awards used with permission of Tony Awards Productions.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
Laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.